don't let yourself be dissuaded by the statistics. They're true. They're not fake. They're very real. But you can, as an entrepreneur, it's your job to bend the odds of success.
Welcome back to Series 11 of 40 Minute Mentor, your pocket-sized career mentor on a mission to raise aspirations and inspire the next generation of category-defining founders. From purpose-led entrepreneurs to world-class investors and even Olympians, you'll learn firsthand from today's successful leaders on what it takes to be brilliant, all in just 40 minutes. Today's 40 Minute Mentor is Richard Robinson, founder and CEO of Robin AI, a contract technology company that has built the fastest contract experience in the world. It was while he was working as a lawyer that the concept behind Robin AI was born. And what a journey it's been since. They've recently raised their 20 million Series B round. So 2024 is set to be a very exciting year for the team. And I can't wait to hear all about it in this episode. So Richard, thank you so much for joining us today. I think you're on the other side of the pond. So an extra thank you for making the time. How are things?
Yeah, good. Good. Thank you very much for having me. Really great to be here. It's a little bit surreal, I have to be honest, but it's good to be here.
Oh, well, it's a real privilege. I've heard fantastic things about you and Robin AI, so I'm really looking forward to digging into your career journey and hearing all about the great work you're doing at Robin AI. But before we do that, we're going to warm you up with some quickfire questions. All right, question one. The most memorable day in my career was when?
When I started Robin AI, the first day of work.
Amazing. When was that?
March 2019, I walked into a shared co-working space, sat up my laptop, and for the first time since I was at school, really, I had no idea what to do. No one was telling me what to do. I had no meetings in my diary. It was all down to me. It was the proudest but also most terrifying day of my entire career.
And those two things go hand in hand throughout the entrepreneurial journey, don't you? Just constantly facing the unknown. But I guess that's often what inspires founders to kind of go on and disrupt things. So awesome. Thank you. One word others would use to describe me is?
Passionate. I think people know that I'm capable of deep obsession when I'm impassioned and I find things in life that drive me. And when I do, I become pretty good at them. So definitely passion.
Love that. Yeah, I would say the same, actually. Awesome. My biggest failure to date is?
I failed to win the World Debate Championships when I was the coach of the England debate team, the World Schools Debate Championships. We made the semifinals and we were knocked out, unfortunately. So I didn't manage to get the team into a place where they were able to win. That's probably the biggest failure of my career today.
We'll have to come back to debating a bit later. Any football fans know that England penalty shootouts and you know, semi-final losses, that's par for the course. But no, that's a really interesting one.
We're used to it.
Indeed, indeed. I measure success by?
How many people's lives you've improved. I really think that, especially being an entrepreneur, for me, what I get out of it is impact, whether it's employees who you take a chance on or you give them the platform to do their best work, or it's customers that you're helping, or it's the world at large who gets the benefit of this new thing you've brought to the world. I think the measure of success is about how much you touch people and give them a chance to improve their lives.
Love that answer. Thank you. And final quickfire question. If there was one thing I could change about entrepreneurship, it would be?
Easier. It is intense. It's so hard.
Yeah. Oh man, I can relate to that wholeheartedly. And I'm sure all the founders listening to this are there cheering along going, yes, somebody said it, but it's so true. Well, thank you, Richard. And thank you already for being so honest. This is a great start to this conversation. It's important. And this is part of why we have this podcast. Let's tell the real truth of the founder journey. But we're going to dig deep into the Robin AI story, of course. But before we get there, would love to, for our audience that don't know your background, do you mind sharing a bit of an overview of your CV, sort of whistle stop tour, and any of the kind of key milestones along the way to becoming a founder?
Yeah. So I'm from Birmingham. My parents are immigrants from Jamaica. I went to school in Birmingham and then I went to university in Manchester where I studied law. I was very lucky. I was a good student, I guess. I did pretty well there. And I got a job at Clifford Chance, one of the top law firms in the world. Before starting, I was the coach of the England debate team. I got to coach debate all over the world. It was something I did at sixth form college and at university and developed real skill for. So I was coaching before I started in the law too. And then I spent 6 years in the legal industry. Most of that was at Clifford Chance and then for a litigation firm led by a famous litigator, David Boies. I worked at his London office. And then I started Robin AI in March 2019. To date, we have about 110 employees. We obviously started with just me. We've raised about $32 million to date, 72 customers all over the world. So been quite the journey.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing. What an amazing ride you've been on. And you mentioned the debate piece. I just wanted to ask, that's definitely a first for the podcast. So how would you say that skill set has helped you in your law career initially and now as a founder?
Yeah, I think for me, it was pretty transformational. I didn't go to a stellar secondary school. It was in special measures while I was there. And so I think I came out of it pretty undereducated relative to the very best people. And I know that because I went to a sixth form college, which was really elite. And everyone there was smarter than me. Everybody there was a better student. They could write better. They could speak better. They knew more facts about the world. And it was very apparent to me that I had some gifts, but I was behind. And the thing that really helped bend the trajectory for me was debate. My English literature teacher asked me to come to the debate class. And that really made a difference. It helped me just learn more facts about the world because you just get embarrassed if you don't know what you're talking about. It helped me to be more organized as a writer and as a speaker, which really surprises me even now how much I draw on those skills. And it just gave me a pastime where I've met many of my best friends from this activity. So it really helped me. And throughout my career, those skills come in handy, right? If you can write cogently, if you can speak cogently, if your thoughts are organized, and if you can see both sides, it really helps you make decisions and think ahead. So it's been transformational for me, I'd say. And coaching, maybe I'll just add, was even more enriching. I think I wouldn't have started on the entrepreneurial journey if I hadn't been a debate coach, because it taught me the value of coming up with a plan, building a team, and executing against that plan, and how you can make a difference in people's lives if you take them on these highly ambitious journeys. It was very analogous to what I was trying to do in the law.
Wow, absolutely love that. Yeah, and I think it just goes to show anyone listening to this the power of debating and how impactful that can be, and also coaching. But it's funny, I sort of know there's a company called Debate Mate. I don't know if you come across them, but they go into...
Yeah.
They do wonderful work. And I went to see some young kids they were phenomenal debaters. And it was just so powerful to see the confidence that came from the delivery and just a really impressive thing. And I just came away from that thinking, wow, my 8-year-old daughter, I would love to get her involved in this. So it's great to see how debating has played an important role in your career. And you mentioned coaching too, which is massive. You went on to become a lawyer and you mentioned Clifford Chance, one of the most prestigious firms out there. How did you find your law career and what was it? Because often initially, this is wrong now, we've had quite a few lawyers come on the podcast, but initially I wouldn't have necessarily thought lawyers would become founders and entrepreneurs. So would love to learn how you made that move and why you did eventually.
Yeah, I think it was incredible. You know, it's such a great business. Their clients are all of the world's biggest companies, basically. You name it, they're probably a client of Clifford Chance. And so you get this training in the world of global business that I really think is hard to match, because you get to see everything from beginning to end. And as a lawyer, you have to know all the rules, right? Which means you come out of it with this education in how business works that I think is very, very hard to match. So I really took a lot from it. You're also working with some of the smartest people in the world, which is intimidating, but also just so gratifying. And if you're capable of measuring up, it's a great learning environment. But I would say it was very, very intense. It's not for everybody. It's demanding because that's how they deliver real value for their clients is they have this rock solid obsession with customer delight. And I think most elite law firms have the same mentality. If their clients need them on the weekend, they are there. If their clients need them that evening, they are there. The answer is almost always, yep, I can do it. That was a huge education. I rely on that so much in my time as an entrepreneur. I think that was a real value I extracted from the firm. So I got so much out of the process, but I agree with you. Certainly in the UK, being a lawyer, to my mind, is not really a huge overlap with being an entrepreneur. In fact, it kind of holds you back because a lot of what you're trained to do as a lawyer is identify risks and try to help mitigate them. And it makes you naturally quite conservative. If you can see all of the problems, sometimes an idea never really takes flight because there are 100 ideas why there are 100 reasons why your business might fail. And most of them are well understood. Sometimes entrepreneurship is about bending the odds of success, just being willing to take on the risks, even though it doesn't make much sense, even though it's probably not rational. It's about going anyway and changing the odds yourself. And I think it doesn't naturally come from being a lawyer, that desire and that drive. But if you're willing to take that risk, then a lot of the skills of being a lawyer teaches you, I think, are very powerful. Like I said, client management, speaking, writing, arguing, developing facts, research. You can draw on these and make them an advantage if you're willing to overcome some of those barriers.
Love that. Such good advice. And just to build on that, for any lawyers listening to this that want to escape the legal world and move into startups, do you have any pointers or tips for them before they make the leap of faith?
Yeah, it's extremely difficult. I think from my perspective, because I'm in technology, I really think the key things to think about, at least in technology, are around thinking through the idea you have without making too much reference to competition and instead just talking to potential customers. If competitors are a problem, the potential customers will tell you. Don't worry too much about the competitive landscape. Focus in on the feedback the people you think you want to sell to give you when you talk about your idea. That's one. Two is linked to that. Talk about your idea. I find a lot of lawyers so nervous that someone's going to steal their idea that they don't even start. And that for me is a classic entrepreneurial category error. It goes back to what I said before about risk and allowing risk to stop you in the first place. The reality is, and you know this, James, being an entrepreneur and being successful is mostly about execution. And your idea is important, but the reality is if you could give that idea to somebody else and they could out-execute you, then you're in trouble because your idea is not going to stay secret forever.
That is so true. It's so interesting because when I started my career in recruitment, all the big corporates, I had worked in a corporate and nobody would share who their clients were or what they're working on. They were so, you know, it was just, you do not tell anyone. And I initially, when I set up JBM, I thought I had to do the same because I was like, well, if I tell everyone my clients, I will not be in business because I started the business with a couple of grand and not a lot to lean back on. And then I realized after a few years, I was like, this is absolutely insane. If people know who I'm working with, that's a sign of validation and I should be proud of that. And if I'm not doing my job, if I'm not delivering exceptional service and building those deep relationships, those clients go elsewhere, then that's actually a reflection on me, not anyone else. So that was a massive change in my mindset, actually. And now we shout loud and proud and are more than happy to tell everyone who we're working with because it's almost, it holds us to account on making sure those relationships are nurtured in the right way. It's a really good point, not one that we've talked about much the pod before, which we have to talk about Robin AI. I know our listeners will be like, can we talk about this rocket ship? So tell us a bit about the origin story of the business. For anyone that hasn't heard about it, how does it work today?
Yeah, so we're building an AI legal assistant. And the goal is to build a tool that anyone in the world can use to solve any legal problem that they might have. Anyone in the world. Companies like OpenAI and Anthropic, they're building what they call AGI, these generalized intelligence systems that can do anything, basically. We're not doing that. We're building what we call a specialized intelligence. It's supposed to be a genius at the law. And the goal is that it accelerates a lot of the time it takes to do legal things. But more importantly, that it dramatically reduces the cost of legal services so that more people have access. We want to democratize access to what is one of the most expensive assets in the world, which is legal knowledge. So that's the goal. Today, we really serve in-house legal teams, and our systems use AI to read and understand contracts. So we help companies to negotiate contracts faster. We help them understand what's in their contracts using our proprietary AI.
Such a, I'm sure everyone can see the need for it. And, you know, it's awesome to see. I haven't had to, probably thankfully, use too many lawyers over the years, but I know they're expensive and it's certainly not something that I would ever try and blag for myself. So, you know, what a cool use case. And you know, I can totally see why you're getting the traction you are. You've obviously raised a lot of money. You mentioned, I think, $32 million from top tier VCs. So it's clearly you're on this real journey. You've grown very quickly. But I'd like to take you back to the beginning, if you don't mind. You mentioned day one, which was terrifying. What were those first few months like? What were some of the hardest parts or the challenges that you had to overcome in the early days and as you kind of found some product market fit?
Yeah, I think overcoming the fear of talking to users about my idea was the most prominent thing. I came into it with a pretty loose idea of what I wanted to do. I wanted to build an AI legal assistant. That was always the end goal, but where we started was much more flexible. So I spent the first few months just talking to as many potential customers as I could. And I actually wouldn't even tell them what the idea I had was until right at the end of the process. I would just talk to them about their day, understand their problems, understand their pain points, understand the things that they were doing, what drove them, and what was going wrong. What, if I could wave a magic wand, would you have me do? And it was only at the end of that that I would talk about my idea and test whether or not it really worked. And the amount of stuff, I've been in the legal industry for 6.5 years. I learned more in that 3 months than in that entire 6.5 years, because I was really listening with an open mind to understand how people do their job. It was an education, to be honest. And I think that for me, that is a scary thing, because you want to build something and you want to get going and you want to get confident that the thing you're building is going to work. You've quit your job, you're out of work, you haven't really got the safety to rely on that you had before. Going into an uncertain period where you're just talking to people, that was pretty anxiety inducing, but I really think in the end it served us well.
Yeah, for sure. And have you, what would you say when you look back on it, what are the things you're most proud of, or the most kind of your biggest learnings that you've taken from the last few years of building Robin AI?
Yeah, I think from the whole journey, the thing I'm most proud of is probably the team. We've built a really diverse company here, and we've still performed very well for a European startup. I think we have about 50% of the company are women, something like 35% of the company are, I think, minorities. It's one of the most diverse startups in Europe, and certainly at this stage to have reached this scale. I'm very proud of that. In part because we didn't do it on purpose. It was always my intention to build a diverse team. All the teams I've led have been, but we don't have any policies or rules or quotas. We don't do any of that. We just try and approach these things with a genuinely open mind. And I think we have a thoughtful way of thinking about diversity. So I'd say I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of the customers we have. It rivals even the customers at Clever Chance. Some of the names, I can't share them all, unfortunately, because I'm not allowed. But if I could, I would shout from the rooftops about some of these customers, because they're the kind of companies that are the most significant in the world. It's really a matter of pride when I see some of the people that we work with. And finally, I'd say it's still crazy to me that young people starting their career or early in their career are willing to take a bet on us to come and work with us. It's still so motivating to me to see that people who could have gone and worked at Barclays or could have gone and worked at Clever Chance have given their trust to me and the company, and have given us that early point in their career. I'm always proud when I see these cohorts of people come and start working with us. So I'd say that's what I'm probably most proud of. And man, the amount of things I've learned on this journey. If I had to pick one lesson, one learning, I would say that it's that people really do make the difference. The quality of your team is the outcome that you're going to achieve, basically. You need a team and a plan. And if you don't have both and both aren't amazing, you are not going to win. It's as simple as that. And I think even I underestimated the difference the right person at the right moment in their career can make. It's more than two, it's more than three. Sometimes having the right person can give you 10 times more than having other people who might be nearly as good, but just aren't quite exactly what you need. It's a massive force multiplier. And so investing a lot in getting the right people, that to me is the biggest learning I've had since I started the company.
Ah, it's a fantastic learning. And coming from a headhunter that is so passionate about all things people, culture, talent, it's just absolute music to my ears and just wonderful, wonderful to hear. And also, it's just great to hear the pride with which you speak about your team and the diversity, which is sadly still continues to be a problem across the tech ecosystem and the venture ecosystem. And something that we have always done our utmost when it comes to searches to do our bit in that. And JBM's team has always been incredibly diverse as well. But it is lovely to have an example here of a company just doing it brilliantly well. You are tackling a big problem here, and it's a gnarly one, and probably one that lots of companies have tried to tackle before. It's an industry that's naturally conservative, as you said, and tech-averse, I would say, I assume, from everything you sort of have heard over the years from lawyer friends. So how did you get the buy-in originally from law firms, and what impact now you've had a chance to do what you do and the product's evolved, what impact are you seeing now in 2024 for those law firms?
Yeah, I think initially the way we managed to get adoption was to basically work for free for like a month. It sounds crazy, but lawyers, I think they're given a bad name on technology because I think technology's really let them down in the past. What lawyers do is really hard, and it really matters that they get it right. And so they are just very demanding. And I think what we needed to do was to constantly show, not tell. We needed to prove to people that what we do is going to make your life easier and better. And once we do that, the rest is straightforward. And so we would work for free for a month and prove to people that we meant business and that we can deliver what we said we could. So that was a core part of how we got over that initial hump and the adoption curve. And I think looking forward to 2024, things are completely different, to be honest. You know, when I started in 2019, it was the idea of an AI legal assistant that was any good was crazy, to be honest. People just didn't believe that was possible. And today, I think everybody's using one of their own. They're using an AI assistant every couple of days. People are complaining that they're using them too much to cheat on essays and exams. So I have seen a huge shift in willingness to try these technologies. People are rightly a little skeptical about certain things. But in 2024 and 2025 and 2026, all you're going to see is greater and greater levels of adoption of AI in the legal industry until eventually every lawyer in the world is using these tools. And eventually every person in the world is using these tools either instead of or alongside using a world-class lawyer. And it's going to make the job way more fun, way more interesting. It's going to have a massive impact on the industry, I think.
Oh, for sure. And what an opportunity for you to kind of hopefully dominate that space for years to come and create something that is truly transformative. Love that. Clearly, the hype around AI and ChatGPT has exploded in the last 12 months, but you were building this before that hype. So how has that changed things for you, you know, just the business? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the state of AI, you know, this year and what that means for the startup ecosystem, society as a whole.
Yeah, I think for us, it's changed a few things. It's really, from a product perspective, it was an accelerant. Tools like LLMs, we were always betting that AI was going to keep improving and that we wanted to be ahead of the curve for when that happened and it would be a rocket booster on our growth. And that's predictions come true, which is gratifying. I think it's also, though, made it easier, or it's brought more people to our attention. We've managed to get really great people apply to join the company who 2 years ago wouldn't have applied to join the business. At that time, being in legal technology was perceived as unsexy, a little slow, a little conservative. And now I think people are excited about the change they are predicting in the legal industry. And so it's gotten easier to attract investors, attract candidates, attract attention, attract press. Everything like that has really dramatically shifted. And that is, of course, very, very exciting. I'd say finally, on this question of the state of AI for 2024, I think you're going to see stronger models this year. There are new chips from NVIDIA, which have only just started to get into people's hands. So you're going to see even more powerful GPTs. You're going to see something from Anthropic and from OpenAI, I suspect. I don't have any insider information, but I think they've been pretty clear that their goal is to build AGI. And we know that they've been training on these chips. So expect really big things from the big foundation model providers. But I also think 2024 is the year that you start to see these products really getting into people's hands. We saw a glimpse of that last year, but this year is going to be the one where you really start to see an improved Alexa, an improved Siri, an improved Google Assistant on your phone. Everybody's going to be using these technologies every day by the end of 2024 if you have a smartphone. That's just going to happen. And then finally, there's a dark side to all of this. I think we need regulation because you're about to see quite a lot of AI being misused. We've already seen lawyers who cited cases that didn't exist because they used models that made things up. We've seen deep fakes of Taylor Swift on X get circulated all over the world. And that's obviously distressing for her. I think you're going to see a lot of political interference with disinformation that's generated by AI, scams and phishing attacks on normal people that are extremely convincing. I think the world isn't ready, basically, for how good these tools already are, and they're about to get better. So I think we're going to be playing catch up. 2024 is the year that we start to realize why we need to.
Yeah, so interesting, exciting, and terrifying all in equal measure. But yeah, I couldn't agree more in terms of regulation and also the need to do it sooner rather than later. Otherwise, it could all get a bit messy, couldn't it? I wanted to touch on fundraising because obviously a lot of people that listen to this podcast are existing or aspiring founders. And you've got a phenomenal track record of fundraising from fantastic investors. And you've recently secured your Series B funding from funds like Plural. So I would love just to get any particular advice you have for founders listening who might be going through that process and any learnings or from your experience of fundraising that might help them.
Yeah, I think fundraising is not fun. It's the first thing I would say. It's not a pleasant experience because most founders, I think, are like this. You put your heart and your soul into building a business. So when someone says, I don't want to invest, it's like they're saying, I don't believe in you. And that's a very painful thing, at least for me, to hear and cope with when you're giving so much. But you can't take it personally, even though it's personal. So it's extremely difficult. I would say for me, I've learned a few things. Number one, you really need to run it as a rigid process. You got to have a clear plan, clear deadlines, database with everyone you're going to speak to. You got to take notes of each call. You got to follow up. You've got to just do the blocking and the tackling, things that are not spectacularly complicated, but are part of the process of being an effective operator. You got to apply that mindset to fundraising and you increase your chances of success by many, many multiples, I suspect. That's number one. And then number two, I really think this is something it took me a while to learn. But I think when you're fundraising, especially if you're running a business where it's highly ambitious, it's one of these companies where you're trying to do something that hasn't been done before, which I certainly think we've been trying to do. It's important that you don't go out trying to convince people that your vision of the world is going to come to pass. What you're trying to do is find believers. You're trying to find the people who actually agree with you and just need to be told and explained how you've got the right team to get it done. And that is a really big shift. It's when you're trying to convince people that I think you get disheartened when you hear no, and it's also more exhausting because you're constantly trying to handle objections when really what you want is someone who agrees with you on the direction of the world and just needs help being guided on that journey as you see it. And that filters out a lot of people and gives you the opportunity to focus in on the investors who are going to make a difference. Because if you convince someone to invest in you because you knew some fact or you made some argument or you spanned some story, there's no guarantee it's going to last. And you're really taking these people on a journey. It's going to last 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 years potentially. You want people on that journey who at the end of the day fundamentally believe in you and your game plan. And that will make the whole process much better. So that's something I've really tried to select for, is investors who believed in what we're doing and believed in us.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of those investors is Ian Hogarth, a former 40 Minute Mentor guest, who is also in charge of leading the UK's AI Foundation Model Task Force, which is no small gig. What's it been like working with such an accomplished founder, an investor, visionary, and what impact has he and other investors had, you know, at Robin AI?
Yeah, well, they've had a huge impact. The whole Plural team, to be honest, is a team of former operators who have made a big difference to outcomes because they have helped us to see around corners. I mean, Ian and Karina introduced us to several of the LLM companies before it was really popular. And it was through that those introductions that we really started to accelerate. They helped me a lot. They talked me through issues. They helped me on things I'm struggling with. But most importantly, being an entrepreneur, I'm sure you've experienced this, James. It's really lonely. You face problems and you feel like you're the only one. Having people on the other end of a phone who've been through it, who believe in you, and are going to help you get to the end, actually, that makes all the difference. It makes the journey a lot more tolerable. It makes the pain a little less painful. So I think for me, people like Ian, I couldn't really do it without them.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, 11 years into this journey as a solo founder, and the lonely times exist in some ways always, you know. That's not a slight on the amazing team I have around me. I'm very lucky, but it's just the reality of it. And actually, yeah, having, I mean, in my case, we've got an amazing board of advisors and, you know, some great mentors, and it's fantastic to hear you have people that were so accomplished, you know, in your corner and at the end of a phone when you need them. I want to talk a bit more about the hiring side of things and culture, because I know that's something you've done really well at. But just final question on fundraising. We've talked about the fact that you've built a really diverse company, but the reality is when it comes to diverse founders in the tech ecosystem, it is a lot harder to raise. That is factual and something that we really hope will change over time to come. But as somebody that's done so well at this, can you pass on any advice to any founders from ethnic minority backgrounds or underrepresented backgrounds who are struggling at the moment? Is there anything else that you can advise them, or just any messages you would want to pass on to them if they're struggling at the moment with raising?
Yeah, I would say the advice I gave earlier around preparation and around finding believers applies even more, because the process of fundraising is just going to be harder for you. So I'd say that. I'd say as well, it's more important that you don't get disheartened, because you are going to statistically hear more no's than someone who doesn't look like you. And that's extremely unfair, but it is the reality. And so it's better to address it and arrest it than to ignore it. And I'd say finally, it's more critical that you just keep going. Just know that fundraising is one of those processes that only ends when you stop. And you should stop at some point, but make sure you've given it everything before you do. It only takes one person to believe in you to get the whole thing moving. And I found that when someone invests, others often will follow. And so keep going. Don't give in. And don't let yourself be dissuaded by the statistics. They're true. They're not fake. They're very real. But you can, as an entrepreneur, it's your job to bend the odds of success. That's really what you do. And so I encourage you to treat fundraising the same way.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thank you, Richard. Before we get to our wrap-up questions, I wanted just to talk a bit about your hiring experience, because hiring is traditionally one of the hardest parts of being a founder. And you've done you talked about the diverse team you built and the number of hires you've made in the last couple of years. So you've got a lot of experience of this. How have you found the hiring experience? And particularly, I'd love to get your thoughts on, hiring your first leadership team, because you're often hiring for roles that you've never had to hire for before. There's a lot more scrutiny. They're a lot more expensive. So I'd love to hear what your experience is like, particularly when it comes to hiring more senior talent versus more junior hires, and any learnings in there for anyone else maybe hiring their first, going about their first hires at the moment.
Yeah, I think I've learned a lot. It's been extremely challenging and it is a learning process. And I think for me, it wasn't something I'd done before, really, certainly not this scale. So concrete things I've learned, I think number one, we make a big deal about giving everybody a technical assessment that simulates the work that you would do if you joined the company. And we try to set the technicals up as things that we've had to do recently. So we know what good looks like, or bad, because we messed it up. And we simulate that for incoming candidates, especially for, like you say, people who want to join the leadership team. And I've found that reveals a lot about the true quality, because you'd be surprised that people can accumulate impressive logos or credentials, but at the end of the day, you're not paying for those, you're paying for results. And so the results are usually very apparent from technical interview. I'd say second as well is that you can never tell. You can run all the most rigorous process in the world and it still might not be a fit when somebody joins. And so don't overdo it. The 10th interview is not actually going to give you any more information than probably the second or the third. And so that's not to say you should not be thoughtful. You need to be thoughtful about these things, but you should also accept that there's just this inherent risk in hiring that means getting people in the door is the best way to judge and assess how well suited they're going to be for your company at your stage. So I'd say that's been an important learning. And then maybe finally, I would say when you're hiring, you need to treat it as the most important thing you're doing. Like I said before, the people and the plan equals the outcome. At the end of the day, the talent that you have and are able to attract is going to be the single greatest input into the success equation. So I think you have to really invest in it, over-invest in it, be absolutely involved, even when it's people who are outside of your domain or expertise. Because as an entrepreneur, you will have the unique perspective of who is going to fit in your business, who meets the cultural standards, who's going to help drive you forward, whether they're in your space or not. I'd say that's probably what I've learned.
Love that. And to that point then, just a nice segue onto the culture. How would you describe Robin AI's culture? And what is it you're looking for when our listeners send their CVs to you? What is going to make them really stand out in an interview?
Yeah, I think for us, we look for people who have demonstrated impact. Company attaches a lot of weight to having high ambition and high intensity. So an understanding that achieving great things comes from having a clear plan and then driving pretty intensely at it, taking breaks as needed, trying to find balance, but with an acknowledgement that you have to put a lot in to get a lot out. I think that's important. I'd say as well, we're looking for people who are extremely autonomous doers. So we work as a team here. It's a cross-functional problem. We have legal experts, machine learning experts, software experts, and we need them to be able to know and master their domain, take work where they can be given a goal, go away, come back with a clear plan and execute against it. So I think we look for people who are autonomous, who can drive their expertise independently. It's really important. Then finally, and it sounds contradictory, but people who thrive working in a team, because all of our problems are cross-functional. Very few things can someone go off in a dark room and solve the whole thing. They have to be able to contribute their expertise. But in the end, bringing that together as part of a team is what really produces the results for the business. It's kind of the opposite of what happens at school, where you just learn on your own and fill in your exam and leave. This is a team sport.
For sure. We're sadly at an end, Richard. So I've got three final questions for you. This is 40 Minute Mentor. So if you could be mentored by anyone dead or alive, who would it be and why?
It would be Barack Obama. He's poised, smooth, intelligent, reasoned, calm, grounded, balanced, intense, everything I want to be.
Love that. Thank you very much. And we've got a question roulette segment in the podcast where we've let our audience know that you're coming on and we've got them to send in some questions. So can you pick one, two, or three and I'll see what they've chosen for you?
Okay, let's go in number three.
Number three. Okay. Think ahead to 10 years from now. What would you like the law industry to look like and how will it have changed?
I think I'd like it to look like a boutique industry, meaning there are far fewer lawyers, but their job is significantly more interesting. You become a lawyer, you become someone who goes to court, who drafts contracts, who negotiates, and you're using AI to do it in multiple languages. You understand Italian law and French law and English law. You're working with companies all over the world, giving them advice on how they can achieve their goals. I think that's something that's impossible today because the law is so specialized, so different, it's so niche that you can't handle multiple different things at once. But if we can build the right technology, then one day people will use Robin to give them the intellectual superpowers that makes the job way more interesting. And when that happens, I think everyone in the world will have greater levels of access. And a lawyer's job is to go beyond just knowing the law, to do the human piece and to help drive results. That's what I hope to see in the next future.
Really interesting. Thank you very much. And final question, if there is one piece of advice that you'd like to leave our listeners with, what would it be?
I think if you're thinking about being an entrepreneur, the one piece of advice is to start. You just got to get going. You've got to overcome the fear, overcome the risks, ignore them for a minute. Just start. And if you're already an entrepreneur, my advice is keep going. It's a very, very hard road. I haven't finished the journey I'm on, so I'm aware of that. But I think the best advice is to keep going because it does get better and it does get easier as you keep going. So I wish everyone the best in that regard.
Wise words to finish, Richard. Thank you so, so much. It's been a thoroughly enjoyable conversation, really insightful.
No, my pleasure.
You're building something truly remarkable and it's, you know, a real pleasure to have had a little glimpse into the man behind it and what you've been doing. So thank you for sharing that with us and we wish you the very best of luck for the year ahead.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Richard. Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. I really hope that you found it useful and inspiring. If we have left any questions unanswered, or if you have any feedback or guest recommendations for future series, then please make sure you get in touch on info@jbmc.co.uk. I often get asked by listeners how you can help us spread the word about 40 Minute Mentor. There are two simple ways you can help. Firstly, share this episode on your preferred social media platform, and LinkedIn is probably where I'm most likely to see it. And you can also leave us a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Every share on social media and review left on the podcast platforms really helps us to get 40 Minute Mentor in front of new audiences and share the power of mentorship even further. Thank you so much for your ongoing support, and I look forward to seeing you again next Wednesday for even more pocket-sized mentorship.